This is Michael Covington. You're about to hear a speech titled The Life of a Researcher, which I gave to the 38th Georgia Junior Science and Humanities Symposium in Athens, Georgia, on March 3, 2013. You'll hear me introduced by Dr. Karen Shetterly of the University of Georgia. After the speech, you'll hear an epilogue in which I give some additional material that was left out of the speech itself because of time constraints.
Let me introduce our speaker tonight. I think we're in for a real treat. Dr. Michael Covington, is the Associate Director of the Institute for Artificial Intelligence at UGA. Over the years, he has done research in the sciences, the humanities, and combinations of the two. His doctorate is in linguistics with a dissertation on medieval philosophers' theories of language. From there, he moved into computational linguistics and more recently computer speech analysis as a way of diagnosing mental illness. He is also well known for his hobby, astronomical photography, and he's published books and articles that he's written about. And he is a native of Valdosta. Yay, we have some Valdosta folks here. And he graduated from the University of Georgia as co-valedictorian in 1977 and received postgraduate degrees from Cambridge and Yale. In June 2013, he is semi-retiring, and I think we're one of his last groups to speak to. Is that right, before you become officially retired?
That's right.
All right, there you go. He'll be retiring from UGA to work in the software industry, but will be almost immediately returning to continue work on a grant that he's received recently. So we also are especially privileged to have him here because he was once a Georgia Junior Science Humanities Symposium participant. How about that? One of the first at the University of Georgia.
Actually, more complicated than that.
Oh, okay.
I'll explain the story.
Okay. Dr. Covington is going to speak to us tonight about two topics I think that you'll be very interested in. One is, what is research like, the life of a researcher? And the second is, some life advice for talented young people. I can't think of a better subject. So thank you so much for coming here tonight. Let's welcome Dr. Covington.
Thank you very much for that that fine introduction and for inviting me here. I want to take just a moment to explain who I am and where I came from. Well, they already did that. I hear that the great city of Moultrie is also represented here, right? I lived in Moultrie for a while as a child in the split-level house that's diagonally opposite R.B. Wright School. So think of me anytime you're there. I'm a South Georgian. My wife is a North Georgian. So far as a mixed marriage, it's been successful for more than 30 years. But we are aware of a cultural difference between North and South Georgia. Okay, 41 years ago, I was almost in your situation, except it wasn't the Junior Science and Humanities Symposium. It was the Junior Academy of Sciences, and it met with the science fair. And I was at the Junior Academy dinner. It wasn't pizza. It was some kind of bland chicken-like thing over in Bolton Dining Hall. And I don't remember who our speaker was, but our speaker said something that stuck with me and which I want to pass along to you. That is, don't choose your college major or your career just because people say it's a hot area, it's something in demand, it's a good thing to go into. The reason is, by the time people start saying that about something, there are already too many people going into it. Choose what suits you. There are two mistakes you can make about choosing a major and a career. One is to view college as job training, and the other is to view college as not at all job training. Now, I know it sounds like I've left no middle ground between the two, but what I mean is you have to be aware that the plans and decisions you make today are going to affect your whole life. And at the same time, you have to be not too constrained by other people's ideas of what's the profitable or right thing to do. People will tell you, major in this, 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 or this. You'll have a fine career. Don't major in that, 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 or that. You won't. they'll be largely wrong. It's just like small-scale stock market investors. The stocks they are buying are the ones that are not going to go up, because everybody's already foreseen as much as they can foresee, and everybody has already made decisions. So before I get too far off topic on that, let me explain that I am going to hit a lot of important and interesting topics very fast tonight. And I've left my web address up on the board because you'll probably want to continue the conversation. I invite you to look me up on the World Wide Web. I'm also on Facebook. I handle about 200 emails a day, can probably handle a few more. So I'm very much a connected person. I'm the sysadmin of ai.uga.edu. So people ask me if I'm on the internet. Yes, I am part of the internet. Getting back to the choice of college major thing, though, I will say one thing. If you want to be successful in the future, do something hard. The people who find college disappointing are the ones who look for a major that doesn't involve doing anything very hard. If you master a foreign language to the point where you can actually speak it and use it, or if you master more mathematics than the average person, or if you do something else that's hard that you can do and other people cannot do, there will always be a demand for you. It may take forms you can't foresee today, but it will always be there. Okay, the other piece of advice I'd give on that point is, don't label yourself as somebody who can't do something. If you're a poet, don't label yourself as somebody who can't do mathematics. If you're an engineer, don't label yourself as somebody who can't do humanities. One thing that I learned when I was in graduate school at Yale, in the presence of very intelligent people all the time, and often with the ability to know whether they were being successful or not, is the successful people were multi-talented. And no matter what they said their specialty was, they actually could also do things that are quite different from their specialty. Broad cultural literacy is important. So I could go on and on about that, but I don't think I will. I think too many people have told you that you should live your dream, pursue your passions, and you should. I would just add, you should give society something back as well, and I will return to that point. Let me move on now to the life of a researcher. My job title is Senior Research Scientist. Most people, even my colleagues at the university, ask, what is that? Because the usual job titles for faculty are Assistant Professor, Associate Professor, and Professor as you move up through the ranks. We have a parallel set of ranks called Assistant Research Scientist, Associate Research Scientist, and Senior Research Scientist. Georgia Tech has a higher one called Principal Research Scientist, but we don't have that rank, so I can't be promoted. It's been a long time since I could be promoted. But anyway, that means my job is to do research primarily. I do some teaching. It also means I am not tenured. That is, unlike a teaching faculty member, I am not guaranteed a permanent job. Well, 29 years of temporary employment seem to have worked out okay. I'm about to retire without ever having achieved tenure. No big deal there. You think of research as something that's a caricature of what it really is. Back in the early 60s, there was a movie called The Nutty Professor with Jerry Lewis, and you see him as a chemistry professor surrounded by bubbling flasks of colorful stuff and with thick glasses on, and that's research, right? Well, not exactly. Research goes on in all subjects and even in practical activities like business, and often in things that are not yet divided up by subject matter. This is a science and humanities symposium. How many of you are doing humanities presentations? A few. Good. A few. Anybody want to tell me what the topic of one of them is? No? Yes. Back there.
High school girls' perceptions of breast
High school girls' perceptions of breastfeeding. Okay, I would call that social science rather than humanities, but it sounds like a worthwhile thing. Anybody doing a literary or artistic study? Well, maybe we're not as far over into the humanities as the symposium would like to be, but I like to keep one foot firmly in the sciences, the other foot firmly in the humanities. That's why I majored in linguistics. It was a good way of compromising. And maybe the third foot in mathematics and the fourth foot in social sciences. At least that would work if I were a horse. Research goes on in many different fields. Not all scientific research is experimental. Some is, but not all. In the humanities, we do have something that we don't have in the sciences, and that is interpretation or hermeneutics. A lot of scholarly work in the humanities is devoted to trying to share the experiences of some other human being, such as a 17th century poet or something like that. But there is research in all fields, and research always means finding out something that nobody ever knew before. There are three parts to it, and everybody seems to have only heard of the middle part. The first part is to find out what's already known. You know what they say, a year in the laboratory can save you an hour in the library? Or these days on Google Scholar or something. Yes, that was a joke. I deliberately said it backward. A year in the lab can save you an hour in the library. You'd like it to be the other way around. An hour in the library can save you a year in the lab. You have to find out what's already known, and then you have to find out something further. That's the part everybody knows about, the experiments, the data analysis. Then you have to report the results. At that point, you're almost a journalist. An ability to write well really serves you well when you're reporting research. So don't neglect that if you think you have a career ahead of you that involves doing some research. I like to think of human knowledge as a blob in multidimensional space. Are any of you good at thinking in more than three dimensions? Neither am I, except, well, you're one in a million. Neither am I. Fortunately, there's such a thing as linear algebra, and I don't have to. I can trust the mathematics to work, whether I can visualize it or not. But I like to think of human knowledge as an irregularly shaped blob in multidimensional space, and I will draw it in just two dimensions because that's what I can draw on this board. Looks sort of like a hungry amoeba. This is a large blob representing the whole of human knowledge, and within it is a smaller blob, which is what you know. And if you want to make research discoveries, what you have to do is get your knowledge to come out and make contact with the edge of the blob. And then, if you advance a millimeter, you've made a discovery. If you enjoy learning things, but you're not concerned with the state of human knowledge, then you can run around inside the blob a long time and really enjoy yourself and never make a contribution to science. You only make a contribution to science or to knowledge generally when you find out something that people don't already know. Now, some characteristics of research. I spend my time teaching people how to do research. I should pause for a moment and explain what the three levels of college degrees are for. In fact, let me, even before going off topic on that, let me go off topic on something else, a point of educational history that may amuse you. You have probably noticed that high school and college in this country both consist of 4 years known as freshman, sophomore, junior, and senior. They have similar looking graduation ceremonies. The word baccalaureate is occasionally applied to both of them, especially things having to do with the graduation. Well, I found out why that is. In the Middle Ages, when universities were first being created, there was no such thing as high school. People would come in barely literate. and they would eventually get their first degree, which was called a bachelor's or baccalaureate degree. Well, when high school was invented, different parts of the world chose to do it different ways. In Great Britain, they decided that high school was something that preceded the baccalaureate degree. So to this day, in Britain, you don't graduate from high school. You merely finish or leave school and then go to university. In France, they decided that high school was the baccalaureate degree. So technically, you've heard of an international baccalaureate, maybe, which is a kind of internationally valid high school diploma. That's a French idea. In France, they decided that the baccalaureate degree would be high school, so technically all the university students in France are graduate students. They're going often for something called a licentiate that we don't have in other countries. That's a little lower than a master's degree. Well, the United States decided to do both. That is why you have a four-year baccalaureate curriculum in high school and another four-year baccalaureate curriculum in college with the same names for the years and the same pageantry at graduation. And in general, you feel like something's been done twice by the time you're through all this. Okay, returning from that digression to a lesser digression, the history of the three degrees, and I am paraphrasing what's in the statutes of Cambridge University as I tell you this. What's the difference between a bachelor's degree, a master's degree, and a doctor's degree? The difference is, for a bachelor's degree, you show that you have a good grip on current knowledge of your subject. For a master's degree, you write a thesis in which you apply existing knowledge in a new way. You show that you are close to the edge of the block. For a doctorate degree, you write a dissertation in which you report a new discovery. That is, you actually get to the edge of the blob and push it out. And that's the difference, now you know, between a bachelor's, a master's, and a doctorate degree. The other thing I should tell you for planning purposes is most people who get a doctorate do not get a master's degree. It simply is not a step. Now, I have three of them, two of them achieved involuntarily. The way this happened is I deliberately went to Cambridge for a master's degree and got it. Then I went to Yale and found out that on the way to the PhD, they give you two different kinds of master's degrees. It was literally a matter of the diploma arriving in the mail unexpectedly in the summer. No jokes about driving through New Haven and having it tossed in your car window or anything, please, but maybe you haven't heard those jokes, which are told at Harvard. That's just as well. Anyhow, research is important, and if you ever have a doctorate degree, you are going to do research, definitely. Well, what is research like? I spend a lot of my time training people to do research. I'm also going too slowly through this speech, so I shall now speed it up. But I spend a lot of time training people to do research, and the first thing they have to get used to is when you're doing research, there is no teacher who already knows the answer. The problem has not been worked out where it's going to be possible to find an answer. You're on your own. I call this the loneliness of the long-distance researcher. You have to like reading and writing, not just experimenting and data gathering, because you have to read a lot of other people's research and you have to report the results of your own. There is a continuum from data gathering to interpretation in all fields. Now, you may have been told that there is such a thing as the scientific method, and in order to make discoveries, you must have a hypothesis, an experiment, results and conclusions in a particular order. You were probably all told about this the first time you entered the science fair, right? Well, in fact, in real life, those are orders for foot soldiers, not for generals. Those are instructions to follow if you are doing one small piece of a giant project where all the good ideas have already been had by somebody else, and you're just gathering little bits of the puzzle and fitting them into place. Major scientific discoveries throughout history have involved a change in what is considered to be scientific method. Look at Copernicus, who figured out that the planets orbit the sun rather than the earth. He didn't do an experiment. He didn't have a hypothesis or results or conclusions. What he had was an insight. He looked at how the positions of the planets could be calculated and figured out that it would be simpler if you put the sun in the middle. And that doesn't fit what you were taught about preparing for science fair at all, does it? What does make research scientific is simply that there's a way to know whether you're right or wrong. It's evidence-based, it's testable. The technical word for that is it's empirical. Okay, I want to warn you about something that's coming regarding academic research careers. People like me are expected to get grants to fund research. These grants are given out by the National Science Foundation, National Institutes for Health, and a few other institutions. There are people who have built their entire careers on grants and the art of getting grants, writing good proposals, and so forth. I foresee trouble coming. The number of people in the United States who are qualified to do good grant-funded research keeps increasing. The number of universities that want grants and the amount of grants they want keeps increasing. The supply of grants does not have to increase with the demand. It's not like a consumer product where they'll make more just because people want more. In fact, even if the federal budget were ample, which it's not, there's no reason to expect the supply of grants to increase with demand. In fact, we're facing large federal budget cuts, and it's probably not a good idea to go into a career that depends on federal funding for research. In fact, one of the reasons I'm retiring right now is that I have better opportunities doing something else instead. In fact, I have done a lot of research that's funded by corporations or by the Defense Department that actually wants things done. By the way, what do I do research? What am I going to do after I retire? Several things, not all of which I'm at liberty to talk about, but all involve research. Some involve the Department of Defense, and in particular a project that has a computer read and understand news wires, that is, newspaper websites like the BBC and lots of others all over the world, and spot emerging international conflicts by finding patterns in what people are saying about each other and what actions they're taking relative to each other. So using the computer in place of a room full of people reading foreign newspapers. My liberal friends don't entirely trust me on this because it's Defense Department money. I reply, yes, but it's the one that defends me. I'm in favor of our Defense Department. My conservative friends don't quite trust me on this because I talk not about winning wars, but about preventing them. And I think it's actually a very good thing. You wouldn't believe how much our Defense Department spends on making peace. They would much rather prevent a fight than get into one and win it. And it's often just a matter of figuring out soon enough that somebody has misunderstood something and then getting the message across to them. Okay. I was supposed to stop at 7, wasn't I?
You're okay. You've got 5-10 more minutes.
Okay, let me quickly move on to the other half of my speech, the longer half, which I shall condense. One of the marks of a good college teacher is that he can control the length of his lectures, and clearly I'm not winning at that right now. But I want to share some life advice for talented young people. I think it's safe to say that all of you who are here are here because you have talents that other people don't have. And the first piece of advice I would give about how to use your talents wisely is avoid peer pressure. Now, I think most of you are probably almost immune to adolescent peer pressure, or else you wouldn't be here. For over 50 years, our popular culture has spent a lot of effort and money trying to get people your age to devote their lives to consuming entertainment and trying hard to be just like other people. Even in the era of the hippies, you should grow your hair long. Why should I grow my hair long? To show that you're an individual like me. Individual just like me? I was not taken in. I want to warn you about another kind of peer pressure, which is as you begin to identify with an intellectual elite, you're going to be pressured to take certain positions on matters like politics or religion or personal morality simply because they're fashionable among smart people without doing any thinking for yourself. Be careful. That's still peer pressure. You still have a good enough brain to do the thinking for yourself. Quick example. People keep telling me that because I'm a scientist, I'm not supposed to believe in God. They won't tell me why, only that because I'm a scientist. Well, scientists aren't supposed to believe that stuff. That's peer pressure, right? It's just like people telling me I'm supposed to grow my hair long. I prefer to think for myself. Know that on controversial issues, your teachers are deliberately holding back, not telling you their own opinions, so that you will think things through for yourself. I'm doing some of that now. I'm not going to give you the answers. I'm going to tell you some things about how to think. Avoid snobbery. There are two kinds of snobbery that may tempt you. One is intellectual snobbery. I'm smart, not like all those other people. That is pretty easy to see through. You probably have not fallen victim to much of that. The other is what I call chronological snobbery, believing that people in this century have gotten everything right and people in previous times were just superstitious pre-scientific dunderheads. Some of you have been taught history with that kind of assumption. It's wrong. People were very intelligent in the past, and one of the reasons history of science fascinates me is that I like to see what a bright person like Copernicus or Newton or St. Augustine of Hippo, who had some interesting thoughts about the nature of the universe, what people with less information but good brains came up with. Think for yourself. A collection of isms is no substitute for deep thought. It might be fashionable to be an objectivist, post-feminist, post-modernist Marxist. No, that's not a compatible mixture. I think those four would explode if you shook them together in a flask. But it may be fashionable to adopt isms from highly educated people. That's not deep thinking. In the waning minutes of my talk, and these really are the waning minutes, I want to remark briefly on two major philosophical movements of the past century or so. I'm old enough to remember about half a century. The rest I get out of books. These are called modernism and postmodernism. You can guess which one came first. I think it distinctly odd to be living in an era in which modernist means old-fashioned now, but it does. Modernism is basically the notion that traditional wisdom is worthless and everything needs to be reworked on a scientific basis. It was inspired by the great advances of science since about 1850 or so, and the modernist worldview calls for throwing out everything old, not just old science, but old art, music, morals, religion, what have you, calling it all pre-scientific. We've got to have something new instead. Newer is better. If you don't like modern art, it's because you're not as sophisticated as me. If you don't like modern music and you prefer Bach or Beethoven, then you're not as sophisticated as me. That's modernism. And the arrogance of modernism reached its heyday probably around 1960 or 70. The reaction against it, it provoked a reaction. It was really a rather arrogant worldview. It provoked a reaction which is called postmodernism. And the idea there is the modernist says, now we know everything. We finally got it all right. The postmodernist says, no, you don't. We don't know anything. All we know is that we don't know anything. The key doctrine of postmodernism is you see everything through your presuppositions and you don't really know what the truth is. Well, these are the people who say you have no right to impose your viewpoint on me. That's almost a postmodernist slogan. The rest of it would be, you have no right to impose your viewpoint on me while I'm imposing mine on you, perhaps. I would reply to that. It's a good insight that we see everything from our own point of view with our own preconceptions. But it's not quite to be swallowed whole because, yes, there are objective facts, and objective facts can overcome our preconceptions. That's why we call them objective facts. We do science, we do research, expecting for facts to come and fight us and overcome what we expected. So the trouble with being a wholehearted modernist is that you're arrogant and narrow-minded. The trouble with being a wholehearted postmodernist is that you don't believe in objective facts, and for you all debates are just power struggles, and you have no real reason to be fair to anybody who disagrees with you. I think the right point of view is to, the right approach is to tolerate dissenting opinions because we might learn something from them, because the truth is out there and we can get closer to it by learning from others and by debating it. My closing point is be a good citizen and give something back to the world around you. I'm not here just to pursue my dream. Lots of people have given me lots of valuable things, and I pass them on. So, having left out certain parts of the originally planned speech, I will now conclude, and I have no idea if there's time for a question session. Two or three questions, okay? Yes.
What is your bachelor's in?
My bachelor's is in linguistics. Cool. Master's and PhD also in linguistics. Yes.
As you were looking at speech, computer speech, and how it could diagnose mental illness, what did you learn from that? And secondly, if I may, what books would you think are appropriate for young people to get excited about science?
Oh, those are two very different questions. One of the many things we've found about schizophrenia is it makes people move their mouths less, and this is probably due to a nerve impairment of the facial nerves. And the idea for that project came when I mentioned to a psychiatric researcher at Georgetown that, you know, we can measure certain muscle movements from 10 paces away through a microphone by spectral analysis of speech. The other thing we're looking at in schizophrenia is disorganization of discourse. People with schizophrenia get off topic as they're talking to you, and unlike me, they don't get back on topic afterward. Okay, books to get people interested in science. Oh, there are so many good ones, but I just recently discovered a really good one. Widening Horizons, I believe is the name of it, something Horizons, by Zdeněk Kopal, K-O-P-A-L. Despite that name, he writes beautiful English. This is an astronomy book published about 40 years ago, and it's the best book about Copernicus and Kepler and Newton and what they all thought they were doing that I've ever seen, but yet it's short and very readable. Generally, history of science is good for getting people excited, at least people who are me. That's three questions. Is there time for one more? One more. Yes?
I'd like your opinion on what would come after postmodernism.
Well, there's something called post-postmodernism, but I have not been able to pin down what it is. What comes after postmodernism? Maybe a return to our senses? There's always a pendulum swing between romanticism and rationalism, and that's been going back and forth many times, and modernism was probably a rationalist swing of the pendulum and postmodernism a romanticist swing of the pendulum, and it's swinging back now to something else, but hard to say. I doubt that it will have a name until it's been dead for a long time. Thank you very much for inviting me, and let's... let's continue the conversation by email.
Thank you so much.
All right, at this point you're probably wondering what I left out. To shorten the speech, I left out two brief sections, one of them a piece of moral advice and the other a piece of political advice. Let me start with the moral advice, and it's very simple. Always live by a code of ethics, a code of morality, that is stricter than you think is actually necessary. And the reason for this is to allow for the possibility that your judgment of what's actually necessary may not be perfectly accurate. You may in the future want a job that requires a security clearance. You may want a job that requires a really good proven record of honesty and reliability. You may want to be happily married. Any of these assumes that there are certain things you're not going to do in your youth because you'll be the same person later on, and everything foolish that you did before age 21 does not vanish. Some people seem to think it does, but you can't unsow wild oats. It's much better not to do things you regret than to spend a lot of time regretting them and trying to prove that you have grown older and wiser. The political advice is this. You have more than one vote. Simply because you're intelligent, you're an intellectual leader, you're going to have more than one person's share of influence. Imagine how it would work if our government were changed somehow so that people like you did get maybe 10 votes instead of one. And you could either cast all 10 for the same candidate or spread them around any way you like. Maybe use some of them to influence the outcome of the election and some others to make minor candidates more prominent, people who never could have won but deserve more recognition than they got. If you were awarded 10 votes, wouldn't you feel that you had a sort of duty to become informed about the issues and use these votes intelligently, even if you're not inherently interested in politics? And let me grant that much of public policy is dead boring. You're a leader and you have a special power, you have extra influence, and you should use it responsibly. For entirely too many people, politics is just a matter of rooting for one side or the other as if it were dogs or gators, or in Valdosta, cats or Vikings, or what have you. Just one team versus the other. For a lot of people, you label yourself liberal or conservative. You label all ideas out there liberal or conservative, and if they're the same as you, you cheer for them, and if they're the opposite, you boo them, you condemn them. And the trouble is no thinking is required, no thinking takes place, and even worse, you are unable to think about anything that doesn't come pre-labeled as liberal or conservative. So you can't think outside the box. My advice to anybody wanting to be an intelligent voter is to be well informed and pay attention to facts. I don't want conservative facts, I don't want liberal facts, I want fact facts. And I want problems solved, not just labeled and cheered and hissed, depending on who thinks they are or are not from the same side. I think the challenge of American citizenship in the next 10 years or more is going to be overcoming the extreme polarization, the extreme left versus right tension that we have right now, and getting people to think about solving problems instead of just cheering their side. But I think politics is boring. I do it out of a sense of duty. There, that's the part of the speech that you missed.